Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Did you know that by most estimates, 2,000 guns a day are hustled from the U.S. across the border into Mexico? How much are Americans arming the deadly drug wars? But first, shouldn't the President of the United States be required to seek the consent of Congress before going to war? Doesn't the Constitution say that only Congress has the power to formally declare war? Well, that's been a thorny constitutional debate, and today, two former Secretaries of State, James Baker and Warren Christopher, offered a plan to revamp the 1973 War Powers Act that guides presidents. Here's Christopher.
For the president, it eliminates a law that every president since 1973 is regarded as unconstitutional. It requires the Congress to take a position on a proposed course of action, but it does not require the president to get the consent of Congress.
Warren Christopher on a proposed plan today. Over the past year, Baker and Christopher led a private bipartisan commission that unanimously found that the president, unless it's an emergency, should be required to consult Congress before sending troops into combat for more than 1 week. And Congress should have to vote on that combat within 30 days. So what does that mean? Does that mean the president needs to get permission from Congress with that vote? Joining us from Washington is Julian Barnes, Pentagon reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Julian, explain for us, what's the answer? Because Christopher and Baker say the president only has to consult with Congress, but then Congress gets a vote. So is that consent?
No. I mean, the president can launch a military operation without the consent of Congress right now, and this law would not change that.
Well, I'm going to jump in and ask. In 2002, President Bush asked for and received congressional authorization for military action to enforce U.N. weapons sanctions in Iraq. We all well know that. So taking that example, how would the proposed plan today change what happened then?
How it would change it is that it would require a more strict consultation with Congress. President Bush would have to meet with the minority and majority leaders of both the Senate and the House before after hostilities began. Clearly, in most cases like that, he would seek authorization for war before the war started, as he did in the Iraq case. But, you know, what the commission signaled today was they would hope that the sort of consultation would be deeper. And then once the war continued, it would be ongoing.
Well, they are also proposing a new joint committee that would be set up and fully staffed and would have access, ongoing access to intelligence and other information. And they seem to be saying, both today and in an op-ed today in the New York Times, that their goal is to make it more what the founding fathers had hoped, which is that two branches of government would talk to each other prior to war.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. I think the what they've labeled as the prime problem here is this lack of communication and the fact that Congress, with less of a robust staff than the president, is at a disadvantage when talking about the intelligence, when talking about the national security concerns, and this would put them more on an even platform. But it would not take away, it doesn't resolve these sort of thorny constitutional issues that have, you know, been around since the War of 1812 or before.
Well, again, the Constitution says only Congress has the power to formally declare war, but it hasn't. It doesn't use that power. Congress also has the power to end war by withholding funding. We've seen how politically difficult that is in the past year. So who wins with the new proposal? Is this ceding more authority to the president?
I don't think so. I mean, the War Powers Act that's on the books right now is not enforced at all. I mean, under the current president's view of executive power, the Article 2 line, the president shall be the commander-in-chief of the army, well, that's a line that the current president has said to be almost unlimited power. And so by at least forcing a consultation, forcing regular briefings, and making Congress vote up or down, you could say that it subtly shifts the power back to Congress.
Julian Barnes, Pentagon reporter for the Los Angeles Times, on a new proposal for revamping the War Powers Act, a proposal made today. Julian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Six burnt bodies appear in Tijuana, Mexico. That's a headline today from the Associated Press after a weekend of drug violence along the California-Mexico border. These deaths were probably narco executions. They're often done publicly. One drug trafficking organization's preferred method is to burn people alive in oil drums. Mexican President Felipe Calderon initiated an anti-drug campaign in 2006, and the American Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the ATF, works the U.S. side. But most of the killing in the Mexican drug wars is done by guns, and most of the guns come from the U.S. And most of the drugs being fought over are used in the U.S. In fact, the U.S. consumes over half the world's illegal drugs, while making up only 5% of the world's population. So, are U.S. drug dealers and users financing the deadly violence in Mexico? And are U.S. gun dealers, perhaps unwittingly, arming it? James Verini's investigation in this month's Condé Nast Portfolio magazine is called Arming the Drug Wars, and he joins us now from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And, you know, we hear violence in Mexico and that Mexico is headed for its deadliest year. But how violent is it?
It's so violent that I think many countries would call this something akin to a civil war, not only in terms of the number of people dying and the horror of the violence, but also the threat to the government. In the last several weeks, a slew of top-ranking federal police officials have been assassinated. There have been assassination attempts or planned attempts against the Attorney General's staff. Rumors abound of planned assassinations of the president and his staff. It's a public security nightmare.
Well, because you write, President Felipe Calderon has made one of the most sincere efforts of past Mexican presidents to really take on the drug cartels, and that the fighting has gotten so much more sophisticated from sort of the down and dirty gang warfare, you know, that people are sort of familiar with, to something almost like an armed army.
In the case of the what's known as the Gulf Cartel, they actually have a full-on paramilitary unit called Los Zetas. But aside from more formal things like that, there are many sicarios, hitmen, in these drug trafficking organizations. Guns for hire come cheap in Mexico and on the border.
Let's talk about where those guns come from. You write, the guns move south, U.S. to Mexico, in the same way that the drugs move north. Give us an example. I loved your story about how there's a high school band coach near the border hiring kids to buy guns from Mexico. Tell us.
Guns are a way now of bartering for drugs because there's so much bulk cash going across the border that it's very hard to conceal. So guns are often traded for drugs. But what you have to realize, first of all, is that the border region, it's this extremely porous place. It's incredibly easy to move anything back and forth. And guns are amazingly easy to buy in the United States. Gun stores, pawn brokers, Walmart, sporting goods stores, gun shows especially, and then the thousands and thousands of private dealers who sell not out of stores, but out of their homes, out of their cars. And the drug trafficking organizations procure guns with basically extended networks of what are known as gatekeepers who live and work on the American side of the border. And when guns are needed, they basically organize purchasers who are known as straw purchasers, people often without criminal records who can pass the background checks when background checks are done, and then also drivers, transporters who bring them across the border. And they also have connections to the Latin American prison and street gangs that exist in Texas and California and Arizona and New Mexico, gangs like Mexican Mafia, MS-13, Texas Syndicate.
And so you have people like, as we said, this high school marching band coach in Texas who has his students buy guns from pawn shops.
He sent his students filling out the paperwork. There's a fellow who I talk about in the story named Aiden Rodriguez, who was a young Mexican-American man living in Dallas, didn't have a job, was approached by a couple of Mexican nationals who didn't identify themselves but had said, hey, do you want to make some money? And would deposit cash at his mom's house, and he would go buy guns, always at the same gun store in Mesquite, Texas, near Dallas, and drop off the guns to them. And they were, meanwhile, bringing them across the border. And he was eventually arrested by the ATF, but only after he had bought, you know, hundreds of guns, only a few of which were recovered, one at the scene of a crime where a policeman was shot. One of the most harrowing stories, which I don't mention in my article, is a fellow who's no longer around named Juan Garcia Abrego, who was one of the heads of the Gulf Cartel. He actually owned gun stores in Laredo, Texas, three of them.
And so he's the one who's funneling the guns to Mexico, and he owns the gun stores.
He owns the gun stores in the U.S., and they just go right into Mexico, because in Mexico, guns are almost impossible to legally buy.
Well, let's back up to Aiden Rodriguez, for instance, the young man you tell of who received wads of thousands of dollars, $10,000, to buy nine AR-15s one time, another time to buy an AK-47. As you said, he bought guns that everyone at the ammo depot, where he
ammo
was buying,
depot, right,
yeah, knows are used in drug trafficking. He's coming back again and again and again.
Yeah.
Is that legal?
Yeah, that's in the United States. It's legal to buy military-grade weaponry, as much of it as you like.
Well, you say that this traffic of guns to Mexico is so huge that U.S. gun manufacturers are catering to Mexicans, you know, making guns with El Presidente and El Rey engraved.
In the case of Colt, yeah. And a whole new breed of importers has sprung up since the sunsetting of the assault weapons ban in 2004 and other changes that have been made to gun importing and gun dealing laws. A whole new slew of importers has sprung up in Florida and parts of the Southwest and Midwest, and they're bringing in really cheap AK-47 variants from Eastern Europe and China.
Tell us about these gangs again. I mean, we talked loosely about how they have their own paramilitary cells, and they're fighting the government, they're fighting each other. Who are the characters coming out of these gangs?
Gang is the wrong word, as is cartel. Those imply contained hierarchical organizations. These drug trafficking organizations have evolved a lot. The Mexican DTOs, as they're known, came up in the 70s and 80s, and they were basically transporters. Since the U.S. government cracked down on the Cali cartel and Pablo Escobar and the Ochoa brothers in the 90s, the Mexican DTOs have become vertically integrated. They now control manufacture, transportation, and distribution. And they are highly cellular and dispersed in structure. So in many instances, when the guys who are known as the head of the cartels to the American and Mexican government, if they were to be taken out or arrested, oftentimes the functioning of the DTO doesn't change all that much because it is so cellular and adaptable. But to answer your question about who these people are, in some of the most striking instances, they're actually former cops. And the swinging door between the police, even up to the federal level, and traffickers is swinging all the time, and it has done for decades.
In fact, you write that in 2005, Mexico's attorney general reported that one-fifth of the federal force was under investigation. Some cops loyal to traffickers supply them with guns and uniforms. But honest cops who work in poor departments also buy guns on the black market to protect themselves. We're going to have more with James Verini. He wrote Arming the Drug Wars for this month's Condé Nast Portfolio magazine. Also later today, a researcher who says his studies show that people still completely unconsciously link African Americans, including Barack Obama, with apes. And once you think of blacks as less than human, you treat them that way. We'll hear that story today as well. Back in 1 minute with James, Here and Now. We're back with more of our conversation about the violent drug wars in Mexico with James Verini, who says Americans are arming a civil war in Mexico. He wrote Arming the Drug Wars in this month's Condé Nast Portfolio magazine. James, you spoke earlier of a paramilitary unit called Los Zetas. They work for one of these drug trafficking organizations, DTOs. But their ranks are filled with former Mexican officials. They were formed out of a Mexican Special Forces unit. Now they reportedly disarm the local police.
They have thoroughly corrupted the police. The cops often are traffickers or help traffickers. And it's no wonder, because being a cop in Mexico is a thankless job. There are about 400,000 local police in Mexico. And for the most part, they're pitifully underpaid, understaffed, underarmed, And, you know, the temptation to get into the trafficking business must be irresistible and constant.
What does it feel like on the streets where all of this is taking place? You were there. You talk about speaking with a State Department official in a restaurant, and a kid looks at you and ducks back out, and you're told, well, someone went to tell Azeta, you know, a gang member, and they'll follow us. And
the Halcones, as they're known, they're like lookouts. Yeah.
Yeah. What's it on the like on the ground for people who live there? And do they know that these gangs are pretty much armed with American guns?
Yes, the Mexican populace know very well where the guns come from. The atmosphere on the ground varies greatly. On the border, it feels like a demilitarized zone. You drive along the highways and the roads there, and you see agents in face masks and camo and body armor hunched behind sandbags with huge machine guns. There's a similar feeling on the American side of the border as well. When you drive around the highways and byways and small roads of South Texas and Arizona, every few miles you come upon Border Patrol checkpoints. So the entire border region has a kind of a bellicose feel about it right now.
We're familiar with gun laws, a lot of reporting recently because of the Supreme Court decision declaring that individuals in the U.S. have a right to own a gun. And after campus shootings, you know, we hear all sorts of reports on how gun owners have to fill out an ATF sales form, but the agency doesn't collect them, dealers keep them, and there's no database of who owns or buys guns in America, all of those issues.
Yep.
Given all of those tangled American issues around guns, where do you see this going?
I think I see this situation getting worse before it gets better. The DTOs have demonstrated amply that they can get to the highest law enforcement officials in Mexico. And then on the American side, in terms of the flow of guns going to Mexico, even though there are 110,000 licensed gun dealers in the United States, the percentage who are actually selling guns illegally is very, very small. The ATF is a large enough agency that it could probably do away with most of them, but they're so hamstrung by federal law that they can't. Those laws are not going to change anytime soon.
But some people, for instance, at the Brady Center in Washington, hoped that the recent Supreme Court decision would do away with the argument that any gun regulations meant a slippery slope to taking guns away, because the court ruled individuals have the right to own guns. So the hope was that now there can be a stiffening of, you know, how you might buy or use a gun, given that you can legally own one. But you say what to that?
Well, I'd say that the real change in law is not going to come from the courts. It would come from Congress. The problem is, if you stand up and try to enforce stricter gun laws, an organization like the NRA can marshal its many members and millions of dollars to fight you. But on the other side, the Brady campaign against gun violence, they don't have anything like the resources that an organization like the NRA does. So if you're a politician, you're going to stand up, you basically have to be alone in that fight. Mm-hmm. And very few politicians are willing to do that anymore.
Meanwhile, you write that in 2003, a former NRA lawyer testified in a Brooklyn court that the gun industry has known for years that it's supplying these guns to gun traffickers. But what did a Colt manufacturing official tell you when you asked about, you know, his knowledge of gun trafficking?
He claimed that Colt had no knowledge that Colt arms or any other arms were being trafficked into Mexico from the United States. But he did admit that some client had ordered a bunch of Colt 38 Supers with, I forget whether it was El Rey or El Presidente, inscribed on the barrels. And when I asked him why he thought the Colt 38 Super was such a popular gun in Mexico, he said, well, probably because you can't get the Colt 45.
Meanwhile, you went to a gun show at a fairground in Phoenix, Arizona, and, you know, kind of looked around and assessed what was going on there. Could you just put in a nutshell what you saw?
It's a cross-section of Americans. You've got young people, old people, white people, black people, Hispanic people, Asian people, Iraq veterans, cops, hunters, target shooters. You know, most of these people, completely law-abiding citizens. But the downside of gun shows is that they're basically completely unregulated. Ammunition, for instance, you don't need to show identification to buy ammunition, no matter how powerful. You can go in there and buy 50 caliber bullets if you want, and you don't have to show identification. And anyone is allowed to privately sell from their own private collection of guns without being a licensed firearms dealer in the United States.
Well, I was thinking, too, that, you know, you look around and you see all these people who may be a hunter looking for one gun or, you know, as you said, law-abiding citizens. But with your trained eye, you also saw what?
You can see people who probably should not be buying what they're buying. For instance, I saw men who, judging by the license plate of their SUV, which I went and took a look at in the parking lot, were probably Mexican nationals who were buying thousands and thousands of rounds of AK-47 bullets. You can also see plenty of people who look like straw purchasers, young women, pregnant women, people who obviously, you know, don't have much interest in guns, who are probably buying for other people. And in fact, you can sometimes see those other people looming nearby. That's how easy it is and how uncautious they've become.
That's James Verini. His article, Arming the Drug Wars, is in this month's Condé Nast Portfolio magazine. James, just fascinating. Thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, still ahead today, new music and a novella from Ry Cooder. He talks about bygone California, a place where strange people were the norm. Ry Cooder, still ahead, after the news, here and now. Barack Obama is speaking at a campaign stop in Powder Springs, Georgia today as part of his strategy to contest even solidly Republican states. That may be a sign of post-racial America, but will race still be a liability for Obama in the fall? There was an ad for E-Mobile that was pulled in Japan. It featured a monkey running for president with a sign that said change. Then there was the Sock Obama, a plush toy picture Curious George with a suit and a campaign button. It caused such a stir that the toy makers, a couple from Utah, pulled it from production with a hint of hurt feelings. They said, "We don't think in terms of myths, fables, or fairy tales." Well, is it just myth or fable that people equate negatively blacks with monkeys? Philip Goff says no. He's a psychology professor at the University of California, Los Angeles. He says his research shows that people still subconsciously link blacks to monkeys, and that leads to discrimination and violence. He joins us. Philip, welcome.
Thank you very much.
There is a history of racist images that were once acceptable. Crude cartoons of African Americans with, you know, long arms, overly large lips, popular in the Jim Crow era. But those would be seen as horrifying now. And now, I would guess more people haven't seen them than have. But walk us through your research, because you studied, first of all, white male college undergrads at Stanford and Penn State, and found that, you know, there's still some sense of these images. Take us through that research. What did you do and what did you find?
Well, for the first set of experiments, we used males of all different races and hues mostly at Stanford University. And what we did in that case was we subliminally primed them either with nothing or with pictures of black male faces or pictures of white male faces. Now, subliminal priming is just we show them the image and we show it so fast that their brains recognize it, so it activates that concept in the brain, but they're not consciously aware of it. Right, so what we're getting is the implicit association between what we've activated and whatever we're testing. They then got to watch a movie, and the movie started off as snow, for those of you who are old enough to know what snow looked like on television.
It's kind of hash.
Or just grainy.
Yeah, right.
And then it got clearer and clearer what the image was. And the image was either of apes, like monkeys, chimpanzees, orangutans, or it was of non-ape animals, kangaroos, fish, squirrels. What we found was that participants who had been primed with black male faces could figure out that they had seen an ape faster than if they hadn't been primed with black male faces. And they were slower to find that ape when they had been primed with white male faces than when they'd been primed with nothing.
How would these young people in particular make that connection if they've never seen depictions of African Americans as monkeys?
Right, well, that's a really interesting scientific question for us. This kind of research showing implicit bias has been shown for African-Americans and violence, African-Americans and laziness, all kinds of stereotypes that people are relatively familiar with. The thing that was shocking for us is that our undergraduate students showed almost no knowledge of this stereotype. So it had been communicated somehow in the ether of the culture. And it seems like what is happening is that African Americans are represented in general as pre-evolved, less civilized.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, you found after studying hundreds of stories in the Philadelphia Inquirer that black prisoners or convicts, people who had been charged, suspects, were more likely to be described with animal-like language, savage, beastly. And what do you think the consequences of that are?
Well, I mean, sadly, that's some of the most depressing research that we conducted. The dependent variable, the outcome we were looking at, was the likelihood that defendants were put to death. African Americans who were significantly more likely to be described in ape-related language in the Philadelphia Inquirer, those same African Americans were also more likely to be sentenced to death.
You also speak of evolution, and a colleague, Jennifer Eberhardt, who was also a professor at Stanford, mentions one of the funny, nuanced ways that people may pick up on this thinking. It's that Time Life book, Early Man Graph. We all remember this. It was, you know, sort of a graph of evolution beginning with a chimpanzee and ending with a white man. Mm-hmm. Now, what does that say to you?
Well, the image is taken from early anthropological drawings and sketches of the evolution of humanity, and early anthropological teachings suggested that somewhere in between chimpanzees and white men were black men. And so those same drawings used to have, as the intermediary point, peoples of African descent. And so I think that somehow in our culture, and again, we're still in the process of doing this research, we have not pinned down the mechanism, but somehow in our culture this has gotten into the drinking water.
Well, on the other hand, if the chart showed man evolving from chimp to black man, wouldn't that have done more to cement the image of black man with simian?
Yeah, I don't think that we can reduce it to any one chart or any one individual or even any one sort of historical set of representations. It's a broader cultural representation. Like I said, you'll find it in political cartoons, on television, in your history books, maybe even in your biology books, this connection.
Well, we talked about an early experiment. In a subsequent experiment, you concluded that if people did associate blacks with apes or monkeys, they're more likely to condone violence against blacks. Tell us about what we'll call the cops experiment, you know, after that TV show.
Right. We were looking to see if perhaps public opinion of videotaped police beatings was affected by this representation. So what we did was we showed people an actual police beating where a group of police officers are beating an individual quite severely. And we told them that they were beating an African American. You couldn't tell from watching it. And prior to seeing the video, they were again subliminally primed with either ape-related words, so the word chimp, orangutan, so forth, or big cat words, so lions and tigers, and then they watched the video. And those who were primed with the ape-related words actually thought that the beating was more justified than those who were primed with words like big cat.
Because, I mean, you deduce from this what, that they saw them as less than human, and so it was justifiable?
That's right.
Professor Goff, Philip Goff, are you African-American?
I am, as is Jennifer Eberhardt.
Well, and you were being a strict scientist and a researcher here, but I wonder how much your own personal feelings come in, because we go back to the Sock Obama. The couple in Utah that came up with the monkey doll to represent Senator Obama said it was just a harmless coincidence. Is it possible that there's a couple in Utah that has no idea what you're talking about when you talk about racism, and that it's just a cute doll?
I think it's not only possible, it's probable. They likely were doing this thinking that it was adorable, perhaps because of these implicit associations that they may hold.
I'm trying to think if anyone would ever make a John McCain monkey doll.
No, probably not. We use monkeys to talk about people we think of as not particularly evolved, not particularly competent, going on emotion and instinct rather than intellect. But I think, honestly, that as we begin to have a more open conversation about race and racism, one of the least interesting questions that we can engage is, who's racist? Who is and who isn't? Let's find them out. That's not a particularly interesting question. What is an interesting question is, what hurts? I'm not interested in whether or not this couple from Utah is or isn't racist, right? What is an interesting question is, does it do harm? I'm saying that there, you can have racism without having racist individuals.
Philip Goff, psychology professor at UCLA. Philip, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Okay, tomorrow, housing activists stunned to find the voucher program meant to move poor people out of public housing may have actually stranded them and caused more violence. That's tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now.
You told everybody that I couldn't drive, and you didn't even want me around, and you knocked my love, and you know that's a lie. 'Cause I'm a good man when the flag goes down. I'm gonna drive like I've never been hurt.
The latest chapter in guitarist Ry Cooder's long music career is the final installment in his California trilogy, which began with Chavez Ravine in 2005 and My Name is Buddy last year. The new CD is called I Flathead. It's an album of music by the fictional car racing roadhouse musician Cash Buck, that's K-A-S-H-B-U-K, and his band The Clowns, Clowns with a K. There are also characters in a novella written by Ry Cooder that comes with the deluxe edition of the CD. The music and the novella tell the story of Cash and his friend Shaky, a mysterious mechanic from another planet, along with various friends and enemies living in a bygone California filled with seedy dance halls and sinister plots. It's a world, as Cooter writes, where strange people are the norm. And Ry Cooder joins us from the studios of KCRW in Santa Monica, California, with more. Ry Cooder.
That was good.
Thanks.
That's the best I've heard that done. People say, what is this? I have a hell of a hard time.
Well, my next question was going to be, what are you smoking?
you have to get the word out. There's a story everywhere, behind every door, I think, in Los Angeles, and the Los Angeles that I remember when I was growing up. It always seemed like there was a story behind every door, all these little houses and people with their jobs and their lives, you know, not remarkable, not heroic.
And now you're sitting there in Santa Monica, and I'm reminded that there used to be all those wonderful little houses in Santa Monica, and they're gone.
That's true. You bet they're gone.
Well, your character, Cash Buck, is a car racer turned musician. Inside, he says he's about 1,000 years old. Here he is singing the song. I asked you about what you were smoking. Here he is asking, can I smoke in here?
Can I smoke in here? Can I sit down? Am I bothering you? Are you alone? Is my tie on straight? Do you rate me polite? Do I need a shave? Or do I seem all right?
So who is this guy, Cash Buck?
Well, he's the kind of guy you would have met, like, say, in 1950 and 1955, working in a defense plant or working in the shipyards in Wilmington down in the harbor, or maybe, in his particular case, in the meatpacking in Vernon. Just an ordinary white guy who likes honky-tonk music, because a lot of the people who came out here during the war and then after were from the border south, sometimes called Okies or Arkies or whatever, and they liked this music, and it grew up here as well. It was transplanted by musicians who came out here to work in the record industry, because there was a record industry here, and they started doing it in bars, and Leo Fender made guitars for them, and they like cars too.
Yeah.
They like to go fast and play loud.
Let's talk about the cars. The title of the CD, a flathead, is that a type of engine?
Yes, it's a Ford flathead, introduced in 1932, small little V8, cheap to make, and it was peppy. You know, Ford figured that the average Joe liked to go fast, but he didn't have a lot of money to spend, so he could go out and buy one of these cars, and they made these flathead V8s. Ford made them until 55, I think. So there was millions of them, and you could get one for $10 and or $20 and soup it up. These guys had learned some technology during the war in Southern California, and there was a lot of cheap technology available. You could put fancy carburetors on these things and change the manifold and take it out to the desert, which was, you know, a two-hour drive, and you could run this thing as fast as you could, because you wouldn't run into anything, because it was nothing but sand and Joshua trees.
You just bring along some Lucky Strikes, some donuts, and some T-Bird wine.
T-Bird wine, that's right.
And go out and drive. Let's listen to one of the songs. It's called Flathead one more time.
3 o'clock this morning, I woke up in a dream. Thought I heard a flathead motor roar. I thought I smelled.
Flathead one more time from Ry Cooter's new CD, I Flathead. We're going to have much more music and much more from Ry Cooter in 1 minute, here and now.
Something like a hot, dry wind whistling past my ears.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
I'm recording again and you know why. Well, I need money, babe, and that's no lie. Fernando says my car is trash and he wants cash.
That's the song Fernando Says from guitarist Ry Cooter's latest CD, I Flathead, the last in a trilogy that started with the CDs Chavez Ravine and My Name is Buddy, and pays homage to his home state, California. I Flathead features Ry as fictional car racing musician Cash Buck and his group, The Clowns, the band, and Cash's friend Shaky, a one-armed car mechanic from another planet, are also featured in a novella written by Ry Cooter that's part of the deluxe edition of the CD. And the novella includes maps so you can trace the path these characters follow through a bygone world. And Ry Cooter, it sounds like it's a world you seem to be yearning for.
Well, sure. I mean, Chavez Ravine and Buddy and this record are all really for me. What I am saying basically here is this is the life I remember. This is the time and the place. It's not like this anymore. You know, life is different now in Los Angeles, obviously.
Well, you know,
and I'm a different guy. I mean, I'm 61 this year, so. But I can remember everything, you know, I guess you'd say, like it was yesterday.
Well, I was thinking it's different, you know, on the other end of the continent. I grew up on Long Island, and, you know, we used to climb around in these hills and everything, and now it's complete suburbs. So there's been a lot of change. But you write about communities that have been uprooted. Your earlier CD, Chavez Ravine, was about a Mexican-American community that was just kind of bulldozed to make way for Dodger Stadium.
As L.A. grew, the people that planned it, who were the developers, the commercial developers, I call them the satanic builders. And they looked out and they saw these enclaves of poverty, or what we would call poverty, which was really just people who were working, people who lived their life and had their place. But it was easy to take that. You know, you couldn't go to Beverly Hills and say, I want Wilshire Boulevard for my next freeway. You couldn't do that. So you went down where they didn't have a voice or didn't have power, and you had the police to cooperate and the FBI to cooperate in case anybody waved a sign like these people in Chavez Ravine did. You know, they went down and demonstrated. It was a very early Chicano power, 1949. Don't throw us out. Don't do this to us. And then they had Chief Parker and J. Edgar rushed in to take care of that and scream communist, and it worked pretty well. Kind of thing they do today. It's never stopped, and it happens everywhere from Long Island to Santa Monica, you know.
Well, here in Boston, there was a community called the West End to go with the North End and the South End, but it was completely removed.
Yep.
Well, is this a quixotic thing on your part? You know, it's like shaking your fist against the windmill, or do you really think you can affect change? Or is it just about nostalgia?
Well, I don't trust the word nostalgia because I'm the same person I was when I was 8 years old. You know, I still like the same cars. I still like the same songs. So nostalgia is not a product for me. It's just what interests me. So I think to myself, let's propose this as a musical statement or as a narrative. And I like to do it, so I sit down and I do it. And I don't think any change is going to come, and it's never going to change. And anybody who thinks that just should come to Los Angeles and take a look at what's been done here by the satanic builders.
Well, but you have made change in the past. I'm thinking of the Buena Vista Social Club.
Oh, that's true.
Your appreciation of traditional Cuban music brought them back, or brought them out of the shadows to a lot of people. We're listening to their music now, and then Wim Wenders made a documentary about it. And boom, you know, you sort of bring a group of aging musicians into the limelight.
Well, it was a story that was there to be told. We were all, as Americans, taught to hate and fear Cubans. So I would say, is it Ruben Gonzalez you're afraid of? Or is Compay Segundo, he's the one you're scared of? And people would go, well, of course not. He's a wonderful man. He's a beautiful little man. Look at him with his hat and his cigar. I was saying, see, now you're not scared anymore. Isn't that interesting? Because Pete Seeger had this idea back in the old days that music would create a bridge that ought to be created between people who, in the class struggle, that could be undone pretty quickly by people singing in a room. And, of course, J. Edgar got after Pete. He couldn't have that message out there. It worked pretty well in the case of Buena Vista, and it showed the world that there was beautiful music and these people were terrific, and they could like it. So, yes, that did make a change actually happen.
Back to I Flathead, your new CD. Rolling Stone named you one of the top 10 guitars of all time. Congratulations. And you, or rather Cash Buck, your character, pay tribute to other guitarists in a song on the new CD. It's called Steel Guitar Heaven. I don't want to listen to some of that.
Well, I want to go to Steel Guitar Heaven. That's the only resting place for me. I want to go to Steel Guitar Heaven. There's a lot of swinging cats I've been wanting to see.
And you also, Ray Cooter, give a nod to country greats. There's a song called Johnny Cash, another one here called 5,000 Country Music Songs. Let's speak a little bit of your obvious love for music.
Well, when I was 8 years old in the fourth grade, one of my parents' friends, for a birthday present, gave me a little Sears radio. I twirled around on the dial, and I found this hillbilly station, and Johnny Cash was just coming up and starting. And Hey Porter came on. I was home. I used to find it reasons to stay home from school, and the radio became the main reason. I heard this tune. I instantly memorized it because I had a good memory, you know. So I heard, Hey Porter, give me my bag. What time is it? Are we getting off the train? Is it going to be the South? Am I going back home?
Hey Porter, would you tell me the time?
It's a fantastic song. I said, who is this? Who are these people? Where are they? Then I found out later on, a lot of them were in Los Angeles making records, but I didn't know that right away because I'm from Santa Monica and there's nothing going there.
Are you from Santa Monica?
You bet. Oh, you South Santa Monica, where the aircraft factory is.
Wow.
Douglas Aircraft.
Because your town has really changed.
Oh, brother, has it ever. Well, it's all mixed use now. It's all gentrified and ice cream colors and this and that. It's appalling. But I still live here because the weather's good.
Well, now you've written the music for that time, you know, bringing it back in that way. But into all of this, you drop this shaky guy, this sort of alien car mechanic.
Right.
You know, this like in the future. What's that about, this futuristic part of it?
Well, he's a fugitive. He's a noir character. He's doomed a bit because no matter what he does, his past is going to catch up with him. He thought he would blend in. He thought it would be an easy trip for him because he'd seen much worse. But it turned out Earth people are just as crazy as everybody else, and it's not easy. So finally Shaky says, I can't take it. He takes his family and they go out to the desert where it's, you can hide. People have always hid in the desert since John the Baptist, I suppose. So he goes out there and he tries to make a life and he's successful. And he runs a little gas station. He's got one arm. I knew a one-arm mechanic. And then they come after him. That's it. That's the end, you know.
I'll never drive through the California desert the same way again.
If you go to any of these localities, that's why I included these maps, you can have an experience, you know. You go to Trona, California, it's amazing. Go to Death Valley, go to see the Joshua trees. It is very rich, you know, even today. They can't wreck everything.
Keep your eye on that one-armed mechanic.
He's some cat.
Ray Cooter, with his wide cast of characters in real life and on his new CD, I Flathead, the songs of Cash Buck and the Clowns, also comes with a novella of the same name. Ray Cooter, thanks so much, and thanks for talking to us.
Well, you just bet.
Anything you prefer we leave with?
I would have to leave that to you.
We were thinking of
Riding with the Blues.
Riding with the
Blues is
pretty
cool. Yeah, I like that one. The girl screaming, that's real.
I found her on
YouTube.
Oh.
She was riding in her husband's dragster, probably going 200 miles an hour, and filming and screaming. So I got permission to use it. I think it's terrific.
Okay. Ray Cooter, thanks so much.
All right.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.